You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here to my right, we've got Bobby Summerfield.
Hello, Mike.
Next to him, we've got, wow, you've got a fan club to do.
Well,
next
that was
to him,
hot air club.
Major phlegm going on there.
We've got Scott Gershon.
Hello.
He was obviously gay words.
We've got Forrest Robinson.
You be the man, Mike.
And next to him, we've got Bill Burgess.
Hello, Mike.
And we've got Rob Arbiter next to him.
Hello, Mike. Next to him.
Who's next to him?
Today our guest, you've already heard a little bit from him, is none other than Baxter. Baxter, welcome to the Audio Nowcast.
Thank you very much.
Now, let's give him some hot air, too.
We have it.
Not that hot air.
Please remove your bottom from that microphone.
I have to go ahead and change my shorts quickly.
Now, Baxter, it's a real honor to have you here today. Baxter was the lead singer for a group called Reflex. And back in the 80s, they had one of the most iconic songs from that period, which was The Politics of Dancing. So,
okay, tuck your chins in and sing along with me.
The Politics of Dancing.
There you go.
Politics
of Dancing. No, don't do too much. The writer will get paid.
So thank you, Baxter.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Yeah.
Is that it then? Thank you very much. Bye.
That's
bye.
It. Yeah, we'll see you. But today on the Audio Nowcast, we're going to be talking about a few things. For one thing, we're going to visit a little bit more with Baxter and talk a little bit about music in the 80s and how it compares to making music nowadays. And we're also going to talk a little bit about, you know, some of the things that we have to do nowadays. I call it, you know, surviving in the time of the bailouts, you know, and how a lot of studios, a lot of musicians are blurring the lines between just being a musician, just being a music studio, and now having to cross over into post and having to do other things and having to find other outlets. So that's kind of what we're going to be talking about. But first things first, Baxter, Reflex. Tell us a little bit about your background and how that started and just your journey. You know, you had that one album that came out and then you had another album that didn't quite get released, your sophomore album, after it. Just fill us in a little bit about.
Who told you that?
It's called Wikipedia.
Oh, you read that shit? All right. Everybody tuck your chins in. Where would you like me to start?
Let's start at the beginning. Tell us a little about your background when you started off playing
in folk clubs. I'm serious. I started off, you know, just doing all the Bert Jansch stuff and John Renbourn and all those people. And somehow I got into New Wave. I have no idea how I got there because in between playing folk music and doing Reflex, I played bass in reggae bands, and people used to look at me very strangely in Brixton in London. It's like, are you really the bass player? Are you the manager? Or are you the roadie? But no, I'm actually the bass player. So I used to lean up against a big old bass stack and get very stoned and play things I didn't understand.
Rasta Baxter.
With this hair. That's a lot of rubbing, man. Anyway, they all taught me how to roll a joint, which was wonderful. I think that's the only thing I learned. Except everything below 100 cycles will eventually make you take a crap. I'd done a few little projects. You know, there was something with MCA or whatever, which, you know, somebody can dig up and laugh at me about sometime. And in amongst all this stuff, this older chap who happened to be the father of my future partner, Paul Fishman, in Reflex, heard I'd done this stuff with an engineer called Nick Launay, who's done very well for himself. Thank you very much. Hello, Nick. anyway, Jack, who was Paul's father, put Paul and I together, and we pulled this band together. It was rather a strange lineup because it changed so many times. Initially, we had Phil Gould, who went off to be the drummer in Level 42, and then he left, for reasons. I think it was a pregnant girlfriend, had to go back to college or something anyway. So he left, and then he brought his buddy down one day that was a chap called Mark King, who was a bit of an odd chap, but very much fun to be around. He was a crazy bastard, actually. but he was an outrageously amazing drummer. And then eventually Mark went off with Phil, holding hands. Mark went off with Phil, and they did their Level 42 thing, which was wonderfully successful for them, and right. They were great. Mark was a great front man. He was always fun. The man is a monstrous drummer. He's a monstrous drummer. Anyway, so he left. They went off to do that, and another chap called Roland Kerridge came in, who, again, wonderful, wonderful drummer. And so then the bass player left. It was my bosom buddy, and we'd been friends for years and years. He left. And then this other chap came in. He brought a man called John Punter. And John Punter had produced, all sorts of wonderful people. From bands like Japan and Brian Ferry's lot. He took us in the studio and made it work. And that's where the politics production came from. That was John Punter. And that's when we all first started really having fun in the studio instead of just doing the gorilla, quick, there's a studio open! Get in there! Right? There was politeness around. For about 5 seconds. anyway, so that was a lot of fun. We just happened to be managed by a man called Miles Copeland, who at the time, yeah, sick, isn't it? And he obviously managed the Police. So that's how we went on tour. We ended up going on tour with the Police, doing the Synchronicity tour, or at least a large chunk of it. And that was a lot of fun.
Right.
So this was all packed into about a year.
Wow.
I still go back and remember things that I'd completely forgotten. There was so much stuff happened in that year, including having to write the second album. Well, there was a bunch of politics with the record company,
right.
And that's why the second album didn't come out. But it's a lot of stuff, and what we're doing is self-promotion here. The box set for everything that we did from the Mark King days to the post-politics days is all going to get put out on a big old...
Oh, that's great.
Wow. That's awesome.
A big old thing with lots of songs in it.
a big song thing.
Independently or...
We're just going to end up... We'll just put it out ourselves. We'll do it independently.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So that's being prepared at the moment. It's about 8 CDs worth. There's a lot of music.
Wow.
And I've obviously gone back and listened through all the stuff. And Paul and Rowley have been taking care of all of this stuff in London, so...
Wow.
My input has actually been minimal, but listening through and looking through and seeing all this stuff, it was like, ooh, did I do that?
Yes, you did.
Even it's usually the crap stuff where I go, did I do that?
Yes, you did.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. But that'll be a lot of fun for anybody that's really interested in picking up where we left off.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Let me ask about the song, The Politics of Dancing. Do you remember any of the gear that you used back there, any of the synths?
There was a guitar, and there were some keyboards. we used the drum machine stuff was a DMX and an LM2.
Wow.
And a CR78
that we had these little clocking boxes, these little silver boxes that were gold dust to us. Sorry, silver dust to us. And they had these little screw things in them, and so you could – Bobby's laughing – so you could actually get everything to, like,
so
square, right? Get them poles with.
That's yeah. Right.
5 volts with. Yeah. 5-volt pulse width. Here we go. Oh, no, sick now. And so all of that stuff was clocked together, plus – yeah, that sounds familiar. Who made that?
It's so funny, but we make that noise and we all laugh. But
yeah.
A majority of youngish people, I mean, even 30-year-old people,
no
go
idea.
Like, what's that noise for?
What's that? Yeah, that was the noise that used to come out of those boxes, if you ever listened to it.
But, people don't realize that synchronizing stuff together back then was just the biggest nightmare.
It was a nightmare.
Does anybody remember the offset, just to go off on a tangent, but talking about the same thing, between a Lindrum and locking it to like a Roland sequencer? When you played the sync tone out of a Lindrum, the samples were out of time, 26 milliseconds, so it was a big pain in the butt. So you had to learn to record print the sync tone, then reprint the drum.
Try doing it live.
Oh, yeah, hello.
You go... That's 1, 2, 3 and a bit. There was that. The keyboards were basically.
I can guess one of them.
Go on.
Had to be a PPG Wave.
It was. Which version though?
2.3.
Correct.
All right. I'm old.
Bing, 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 bing.
Here's a quarter.
Actually.
Or 2.2.
It was either a 2.2 or 2.3. I think it was a 2.3. Because I remember.
What year was it?
I remember taking the bloody thing apart because the keyboard, it had been dropped or something, and oh god, that was loud. The keyboard had been dropped and it bent, so you could, you know, remember that the keyboard actually pushed down. Mm-hmm. There was.
That's how the aftertouch worked.
Yeah, there was the. Okay. Yeah, the aftertouch.
After lean.
But anyway, it got jammed in, and we had to take it apart and file it and bend it and whatever. So it was the PPG. There was a Prophet 5. Mm-hmm. I don't know what rev it was. an OB-8.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. OBs.
Oh, yeah.
When's anyone going to model out of that?
And various other little bits and pieces.
There's no modeling of it.
Well, song is... It really stands as like one of the best examples of that kind of production
It was a great track.
It sounds amazing.
And
still.
It was cool. It was a really fun track.
My stuff was just a Telecaster and AC30.
Really?
Yeah. Cranked. And a CE1 chorus pedal.
Ooh. But see, you know, one thing on that, what really stands out are the vocals. The vocals are huge on that song. You know, it's so present. It has such a really great character in that.
So which mic did you use?
Do you remember the serial number?
No. Can I take my hand out of your arse now?
Please don't.
That's not his hand.
Stop. We are dancing on that. E for everybody.
What was the question?
I had a comeback, but that would have gotten the whole thing.
The microphone. The microphone was actually an AKG tube. And I can't...
C12.
Which was basically a C12, yeah. But it was the green furry one. Have you ever seen? You must have seen this.
Mold on
it?
No, it had like a texture.
It was a texture, and that's what made it sound so good. It had a texture to it. If I remember grabbing it and John saying, "Get your fucking hand off that!" You can check that out later.
He's good at editing here since I've been on the podcast.
He's gotten real good.
It was all the whole thing on the vocal chain, as far as I know, was all 80 series Neve.
Gotcha.
I don't remember what the compressor was. Probably one of those bloody Star Trek looking Neve compressors too, 22 something, whatever it was.
And what studio was it?
The studio was there. There were two. The tracking was done at Utopia Studios, which I think has closed down now, which was in Primrose Hill. Mm-hmm. It was right around the back of Mayfair Studios. And the overdubs and the mixing were done at Air Studios, which at the time was in the center of London. Tottenham Court Road and Oxford Street was that junction there. And it was right at the top of the building above... a clothing store, and what was the ground floor store? I forget what that was, but the only way up into this place was in a lift. There was about the size of somebody's house. It was massive. So that's where the mixing was done.
Wow.
So it was done in Studio 3 at Air Studios, at the original Air Studios.
Wow. So
by John as well. John mixed it as well.
Wow. Yeah. Do you remember when you first heard the song on the radio, when you kind of knew it was going to be something special? Do you remember when that
Yeah. You know, there was this beautiful thing that happened in mastering in those days where you knew that as good as you thought it sounded when the mix was finished, you knew it was going to come out of the mastering lab, right, sounding gorgeous and sparkly, and you'd be able to, you'd have this whole 3D thing of being able to look around instruments, and everything just sounded larger than life. And I miss that. I miss that with records today. But the only way you can get it is just to go back to vinyl.
Now, what about when you heard it on the radio?
When I first heard it, it was a total double take. Even though and my head is just expanding now.
That's okay.
Even though I'd heard our material on the radio prior to that, because there were songs released before that.
Right.
Politics was one of those, when I first heard it, was one of those songs where you go, oh, that's really good. Oh, it's me. So that was, you know, the first time I heard it, when that happened, actually the DJ, it was on Capital Radio in London, I believe. And the guy said, there's a new band from America. So I was on the phone about 10 minutes later. I think we all were. So we had to put them straight on that one. So everybody thought we were an American band.
Wow.
An import.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Yeah.
And then when you came over, were you amazed that it hit the States as big as it did?
We were stunned. We were all completely blown away by this. And, I mean, to see people just going nuts at the shows. A lot of the shows, I remember, were full for us opening for the Police. It was pretty solid, most places we went. And people just went nuts. I mean, the odd thing was that we had a record that was higher in the charts than the Police at the time, which meant an awful lot to us. Not to anybody else. it was a great time to see people going nuts over that song. Yeah.
And it's still a great song now. You listen to it now.
Oh, it's great.
It's still got the vibe. It's absolutely smoking.
Yeah, thank you. It holds up well.
It is.
Thank you.
Oh, I said the song, not you.
I know you too well. You would pay me a compliment.
I do. Actually, I do love him dearly, though, dearly.
But how was it touring with the Police back then? How was that? How was that?
We didn't have an amazing amount of interaction with them. I mean, you know, occasionally we'd get together and, you know, Sting didn't smoke. Cigarettes. but we sit around and have, you know, have a drink, right. You know, a glass of wine or whatever, and natter about stuff. And basically, it was just this ethereal thing. You know, we're opening for the biggest band in the world, because they were the biggest rock band in the world at the
huge
time. And it was great going on stage, you know, every night before them. You know, and then they just come on and hammer people even more than we'd already done. So that was great.
Wow. Now, how about one last thing? The transition from going from, you know, smaller venues to going to the giant venues that the Police were playing at, was that difficult, or was that? Do you ever get nervous? Do you ever get scared? Were you in the back?
Yeah. Yeah, of course I did. Yeah. I suppose I still am. I've always been a fairly shy person to get up in front of people, you know, visually.
Right.
Always, you know. So that it was hard to do that. So because I'm nearsighted, right, I used to not go on stage with my lenses in. Because everything was such a blur. It was like, oh, okay, I know there's an audience out there somewhere. Seriously. It took me ages and ages to get to the point where I'd actually go on stage with lenses in so I could see people.
Wow.
It took me ages to get over that.
That's the only way you could pick up chicks, though. He was waving at guys at first.
I tell you, hairy fists up your...
Yes! That's within a tour, I want to say that more.
Okay, that's got to come out too. Yeah, my wife won't like that one.
She does.
Oh, I'm sorry. Nice comeback!
Well, like I said, thank you for being here. And that's, you know, Politics. It holds up so well. It's such a great song. And it's like you can't find it on any type of 80s collection. You can't find a collection without that song being on it, because it's such an iconic.
I was going to say, because I thought you were saying it the other way around. I was like, you want a list of the compilations that song's on? I think it's about 30 of them.
Wow. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
It's a great song.
I'm very, very proud of it. I'm glad you all saw it.
And it's on YouTube, too, if you want to see Baxter.
That's right.
Actually, if you want to see me sing it out completely out of tune, because I couldn't hear myself, go to YouTube. Because there's the original, like, you know, the quintessential reflex video. And then there's also some live footage as well. Yeah, thank you very much.
So we'll have to post a link to one of the videos.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, he looks older in the video than he does now.
Because he was down there, it's quite funny, right? Playing the DJ guy. Yeah. But what they did was they puffed me up with all this wax
and the dodgy glasses
and the moustache. Oh yeah, talking about hairy fists. Yeah, and the moustache. Yeah, and the oh god, yeah. I knew that would come back to
me. Well, at least folks heard you actually singing live in those days as opposed to, like, now.
Say that again?
I said at least folks actually heard you or can hear you live. Yeah. You hear a human being singing live.
Yeah, no auto-tune, no melodyne.
Yeah, Baxter's in the same crew. He's in the same...
Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, why were the 80s, you know, there's something really special about the music and the technology and the sound. And nowadays, you see a lot of younger bands, trying to get the 80s sound and trying to get that analog sound. And what was it about that whole time? Was it that?
I think one of the things is it was a nice culmination of technology, recording technology, just the pure side of recording. Sort of peaked in the 80s. The analog recording got to its cleanest form. I mean, pretty much, you know, give or take a year or 10. But you know what I'm saying? It got around all the problems. You had much better consoles being made but still sounded good because sound was a massive thing. And budgets were still you could still make record companies making a lot of money making records and they could still sell them. They weren't being stolen. So it was a great market. An artist could be developed and would be developed. So you have like 3 or 4 albums coming out. So it'd be a financial investment. So there was a lot of money being put into the development of the technology around making music. We would have a mixing desk for $1 million or so. And now these days, you know, some record companies are not worth $1 million. The actual mixing desk itself. And I think it was at the peak of a good set of recording technology, and also at the tail end of the 60s and 70s, which was a really great formative era for pop music. And I think people said, well, we've got all this great music to draw from, you know, from the Beatles era and all this great technology, and it was a good thing. And technology really did make things
better. Synth technology alone, I mean, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Actually, it was huge.
Massive.
It went such a rate of knots at that point.
I mean, the PPG is an iconic. Obviously.
Well, you had the PPG, you had the Fairlight, you had all the profit.
All the sequential stuff. Yeah.
Fairlight, Pager.
Pager. Oh. And those dots when he's in there.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
crashed again.
But don't you think, like, I mean, nowadays with some of the technology, especially in synths, I mean, some of the synths that are coming out nowadays are way beefier than some of those ones that were down there. I mean, at least on a low end, because, you know, you listen to a Juno, let's say, or, you know, and it has its defined Juno sound, but...
But that's what you're missing. You see, the defined Juno sound, you don't have as many synths these days, certainly when it comes to plugins, I personally think it doesn't exist. I find it very hard to actually hear the difference between...
And I'm not talking plugins, though. I'm talking like the Phantom, and I'm talking about like some of the Motif songs.
Sure.
But I used to be able to go, that's an Oberheim, that's Sequential Circus, mm-hmm. that's a Moog, exactly. Oh, that's an Arp, that's a Chroma. I mean, you could hear, and everyone had
the characteristics.
It was the
identity.
Same difference as guitarists, being between a Fender and a Gibson and a 335, and everything had a sound. And now everyone's emulating each other's sounds. Yeah. There's no
and lots of the plugins are used. You know, other than of course they have their own unique coding and their absolutely that is certainly unique. But generally, it's using the same processor and the same output stage. Whereas the Oberheim had a different voice architecture than the Prophet, so he had a different sound. Granted, it's subtle, but That's the point that we're not lucky enough to have these days, where we have, well, that does sound this, you know, or the Moogs that would classically go out of tune all the time, or whatever. It's like, well, it's...
That was
the character of it.
That's the character.
You know something? One thing I have to say from one of the most beautiful things of touring with Joe Sample has been hearing this brother in every show give... He would take probably 10 minutes... at least a few times, up to 10 minutes, talking about the Rhodes and the Fender Rhodes. And he will break down to the audience if they never heard of either or. And he will tell you, you know, now, a lot of you, you know, you hear the Rhodes, but this here is a Fender Rhodes, you know. And he goes through the whole thing where he and Stevie won about the last 9 from the Fender Corporation before, was it ABC or CBS?
CBS.
Before CBS bought them. And he will break down the colors and the characteristics of basically what you're talking about, the difference between the Oberheim and the Phantom and... You know, and it's, I think that's a beautiful and valuable thing. It's a piece of information that we can all use. I believe a lot of people, more people will appreciate it more than many of us realize.
Let us not forget the kick drum on the DMX.
Oh,
the
absolutely.
Kick drum on the DMX.
That thing just like, it pummeled you.
That's true.
It pummeled you. God, that was an odyssey.
So we know the technology definitely helped, you know, the peak of music technology and recording technology helped the 80s and defined the 80s sounds. But what about the actual, it just seemed like, you know, a great sense of melody. You know, you listen to 80s music and there's just a great sense of melody in a lot of the classic, you know, bands.
Well, also still remember back then, because of budgets and how much it cost to make a record, not everybody got to make one.
Thank God.
So, well, yeah. You know,
that's a great point.
We've talked about that before. Now anybody can make an album and some shouldn't. But it is easy and cheap enough now that anybody can. And, you know,
No. Everybody should. Just most of them shouldn't be heard.
Well, okay. Everybody should
and
make one.
Most of them aren't.
But back then, you know, you had to go through such an approval process to even get to the point where you'd have a budget to get into a studio that weeded out a lot of bad writers. And, I mean, plenty of bad writers still made it into studios. But,
oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I did. I did. Look, The whole bloom of what the 80s were really, really did focus on, you know, if you couldn't sing, you weren't a bloody singer. If you couldn't play guitar, you weren't a guitar player. If you couldn't play keyboards, you didn't get a chance to go and program them either, all right? And you needed a good bloody song, and you needed to be able to perform the damn thing, to do all of these things. I think some of this stuff is missing now.
There is one exception.
And go.
Go. It's My Life in the Bush of Ghosts.
Oh, I love that record.
That's a pivotal record for
it
me.
It's a pivotal record for me as well. It knocked me down. Yeah, yeah.
And that was never performed. It was a purely studio creation.
Yeah. Well, never Steely Dan. I mean, you talk about a lot of people.
It was insane.
I'll pee myself because of that record. That is so good.
It's amazing. First use of radio voices for vocal, all kinds of stuff, and it still holds up.
Yes, it does. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Totally agree with you.
So how do we explain the haircuts?
Well, you know, I had this haircut, but it always went flat, so it didn't really make any difference. the one that's always thrown at me from a technical standpoint is, what the hell was that guy thinking? And you know what I'm talking about.
Which guy?
Oh, come on. Come on. I know you.
Which one?
Boy George
or Flock of Seagulls?
No. Flock of Seagulls.
Flock of Seagulls. Oh. What the? Was he thinking?
I've got to share a funny story. Hopefully, Paige, you won't mind. Maybe he did tell you. Did he tell you this guy? He was signed to the same record company as Flock of Seagulls. And he was opposite, and they took themselves quite seriously, the Flock of Seagulls, for obvious reasons.
They fucking had to. Nobody else would.
and old Pagey he had a couple of drinks, I think, and he was working in the opposite studio. And they had closed out the studio and gone home that night, but they had on the door a Flock of Seagulls, because remember in those days, he used to put the name of the producer and the band. And he crossed it out and put a gaggle of lemmings. And the guy had a hissy fit the next morning. He came in with his hair down, flapping it around.
Slapping people around the face with his hair. Yeah, right.
Yeah,
that's funny. I'm proud of that guy.
Pile of seagulls shit, wasn't it?
All right, well, hey, this is a good place to break, so we're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, we're going to continue visiting with Baxter. We're going to also talk a little bit about Blurring of Lines, and we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were visiting with Baxter and just listening to him just say a lot of wonderful things.
I'm going to get sued for
and edited.
Very colorful things.
Before we move on, Baxter, what are you doing nowadays? What are you doing now?
McDonald's has been really good to me.
health insurance? No.
Yeah, door-to-door shit now. I've spent a long time doing, development with various artists for various different labels and writing for various people and, you know, stuff in films and whatever. It's a bit of a mishmash, really. Nothing really overly specific. Whatever I can get my hand in, you know?
How's your ass?
You're right.
I'm smiling. He's smiling.
Oh, was he talking to me? He was looking the other way.
It was the angle, man. It was the angle. Right?
Oh, man.
That's so rough.
I'm sorry.
Let's start.
Can we start it again?
No.
Rob was a friend of mine.
You don't have to apologize. It's not my ass.
It's not his hand either. Said that.
Been there before.
Oh, man.
I have no way to segue out of that. So we're just going to go.
Just don't bite the hand that feels you.
So, okay, well, let's get to know. What's your after that?
Popsicle, sweetie.
The hits just keep on coming.
Okay. We should just put X's on this one and just say, you know.
Well, that's actually a good segue. Not really, but we're going to pretend like it was.
My hand up Rob's ass. Is what, what on earth are you going to talk about now?
We're going to talk about clients and what they're blurring doing to the us lines. Nowadays.
So that's where they really got their fist up there.
We're going to talk about how hard is it to make a living.
Don't mention that.
Pretty hard.
Clients and hard, yeah.
One thing I want to talk about is, in today's economy, it seems like there are no studios nowadays that are functioning on a pure music basis. It seems like there's a blurring of the lines and people have to do more things and you have to branch out. And specifically, like with music and post, I mean, they are married now. If you're going to be making a living, even, you know, as a songwriter, as a composer, you're going to want to do some stuff, you know, for post-production, for film and television. And I just wanted to kind of open it up, like, with you, Rob, in your studio.
Well. Haven't they always used music in post? What were they using, pancakes?
Yeah, but it seems like there was a time where you could do music and focus more on just being a music studio. You see,
I think part of it is it used to be a different set of people.
That's very true.
Because it was a different set of tools. The guys who were doing the sound effects for a project would be using different tools than the guys doing the music for the project. Yeah. And I think that's one of the reasons that the lines have gotten more blurred, because the tools have become more flexible and can do everything.
And more contained in a way.
But I think post was always post, and music, when they realized they had all these technologies sitting around that wasn't able to sell. Then they went to voiceover recording and anything they can do
to make a buck.
But I think post has always been post.
And there's always
music been... Music said, yeah, we could do post too, I think.
Yeah, you're probably right.
And every third person in post is a drummer. What's that about?
No. I mean, well, when you do look at sound in general, a lot of people in post are musicians. I mean,
absolutely.
Because it's where, but it didn't seem like, wow, the music business slowed down, so everybody came into post. Didn't happen. A lot of recording engineers went into post. Because at a certain point, when I used to do Record Plant in Cherokee, and you made no money, or you made a little bit of money, and the hours were crazy because, you know, you show up, the musicians come all stoned at about 7, 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. They start recording all night long. You do this. Nobody really cares. They all take turns on you. Going home, I did this thing.
What's wrong with that?
And then so then as you're an engineer, and you're like, why? So they go off. They make a ton, you know, millions of dollars, mm-hmm. and you're the engineer next. The next band comes in, and there wasn't a whole lot there. Next thing you know, you could become a live sound mixer making $10,000-$15,000 a week. Screw the music. Nothing against it for recording engineers. All of a sudden, people were, hey, and a lot of them went from music mixing to the music chair in post-production because it was a music mixing, a re-recording chair, which used to be a three-man team. So all those guys came from records. Then they said, okay, then it went from a three-man team to a two-man team. And a lot of them went from music and also to dialogue and learned the technologies. And there's a lot of similarities and a lot of differences.
Well, one thing to keep in mind with how the tools have changed. I mean, if you go back to like around when I first met you, Scott, if somebody – or a little after I met you actually in the early 90s – the dialogue for a film could be edited on, say, a CyberFrame, which was a very post-oriented application that did an amazing job editing dialogue. It worked like a moviola, and a film editor felt comfortable with it. That was how the dialogue for the film might be dealt with and Foley and effects cut and that kind of thing. The music for that same film might be sequenced in StudioVision or Cubase or, you know, a system like that. The guy who was operating the CyberFrame would know nothing about what the music guy was using. And the music guy, if you put that post tool in front of them, would just say, I have no idea how to use this. I've never seen a movie all. I don't know what this is. The tools were not – it's not like it is today where you might have a post guy and a music guy both using Pro Tools or Nuendo or something in slightly different ways. They were different tools that there was no overlap in the people who would be using them. Yeah. It was different unions and different groups of people. And those lines, the technology lines, and I know, Scott, you were one of the first in the sound design world who started using musical tools, and it caused a lot of chaos, I know, early in your career.
For me, when I went for music and then went sound effects, a kick drum and an explosion were the same thing. And snares and glass crashes and cymbals were the same thing. You EQ'd them the same. You sometimes mic'd them with the same mics, using RE20, a D112.
Yep.
All of a sudden, you're looking at the same client. So a lot of times when I'm looking on the sound design side, I'm looking at my music roots at what's the best mics. You know, to grab in a Yamaha, one of those transducer drums, hey, man, let's put that in front of a gun.
Yeah.
Just
like you would a kick drum.
Absolutely. So all of a sudden, it's the same kind of situation. And then when you are EQing and mixing for a full mix where there's dialogue, music, and effects, you're still dealing the same way that you would have a guitar and a piano in a full mix, where you're cutting out a lot of the inside of it, so parts of each instrument is able to come up front and have its individuality. Absolutely. So I just got finished doing that with some music on this music movie called Crank 2, where we had the situation where this guy named Mike, who used to be in Faith No More, he was the composer.
That's Mike Patton.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So really good stuff. It's very grunge, a lot of guitar stuff. I got dialogue. I got guns going off. And we've got to make it fit. So I ended up working with the mixer and really EQing a lot. I mean, just thinking outside the box. But to me, it's the exact same thing that I used to do when I was doing records, where you're going, I know I've got a beautiful, whether it's a Steinway or a Yamaha, but you still got to carve out the center to get all the other instruments through it. Same thing with the guitar. So to me, the similarities between those two industries are amazingly similar.
Well, Rob, you brought up a good point, though. It's the blurring of the tools. My question is, why did the music tools, it seems like they won? Take, for instance, AudioVision from Avid. I learned how to edit dialogue.
And that was pretty cool, actually.
It was a great editor. You could have like nested sessions within sessions.
They still use that at ABC.
Yeah, and then we switched from AudioVision to Pro Tools, which was clearly at that time
because inferior. One was $100,000 and one was $20,000. So if you look at the Sinclair, all of the post production like video services,
right.
They were all really expensive because that's the video market. Then when Pro Tools said, "Hey, not only can the studio afford one, but you can afford one." So all the editors were buying it. Waveframe was so much better. Hybrid Arts, ADAP was better than SoundTools.
ADAP 3, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, everybody was better. But all of a sudden, Pro Tools was $2,000. It put Sinclair out of business. Why spend $300,000 and $30,000 updates when you can buy Pro Tools for – and it's the same thing between Beta and VHS.
On 12.
Beta was a better product. VHS was accessible and cheaper. So true. Pro Tools at the time was not a better device.
It's hilarious that now Pro Tools is thought of as the big expensive.
That's true.
It has come – it's much better than it was then, though.
But yeah. People are saying now, man, Logic, Nuendo, I could buy that for $1,000. I don't want to spend
– $500 for
Logic. I don't want to spend $13,000 for a Pro Tools system.
And you'd be wise.
And now, and all of a sudden, how many people went out and bought a $400 copy of Logic 8?
There goes a DigiDesign advertising.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, they know I think they're anyway.
Well, that's very true what you're saying.
It seems like nowadays, because the tools have kind of gone more towards the musician, it actually makes it easier for a lot of musicians to make a living if they choose to do so in music by working with familiar tools and working with familiar EQs, and it seems like everything is kind of geared, even in post, a lot of it towards the music side. So it's kind of an easy switch. Would you agree, Rob, that it's easier now, obviously, to get into post production than it is when it was? And
well, it's easier to get the basic work done with right. The tools. I think that something that a lot of people don't realize is the tools haven't necessarily gotten better. If you go back to the beginning of like disc editing for post, I don't think the tools have necessarily gotten better. I mean, I don't think that Pro Tools, which I like, I don't think that Pro Tools is as powerful for dialogue and effects editing as some tools that came before it were. I think the CyberFrame was better set up for that kind of work. I think that there have been other disc recorders that for whatever reason didn't take off. I think the tools now have gotten good enough that anybody who's skilled on those tools can basically get any kind of work done. They may not realize there was a better tool 10 years ago, and it may not matter.
What was better about those tools, though?
Those tools were more specialized. They, like, editing dialogue on a CyberFrame, that's really what it was designed to do. And it just had much better organization. It was just really fast. And if you had an editor who's brilliant on Pro Tools and one who was brilliant on the CyberFrame and you gave them the same project, the CyberFrame guy would always get it done quicker. It was just a better design for that one task.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, at the time, I think that what's happening now with Pro Tools, and look, I use Pro Tools and I love it. I mean, it is the device of choice. But what's happening is it can slice, dice, it can make Julian fries all at the same time, and no, it can't. What they're saying is you can mix it, you can edit 192 tracks, you can have as a video player, all these things.
You can edit video.
So my thing is I've done it, and I can make Pro Tools crawl where I can hit the button 1, 2, 3. It can have like a 5-second lag before it plays. Why? Because it can theoretically do it all. The problem is it can't do it all at the same time. Now, I just got finished doing a mix, like I said, and I was, 600 or 700 tracks because they're based on categories. And people go, well, that's a lot of tracks. Divide everything by 6. Everything's 5.1. Now, all of a sudden, if you want 100 sounds, which dialogue, music, and effects is nothing, well, that's 600 tracks because you have to divide, times it by 6. Okay. Absolutely, everything's 5.1. So what happens is I'm dragging 8 Pro Tools systems easily. And the question is, how much do you do there? How much do you do in the mixer? The big thing in post is summing. There's only one bad thing about Pro Tools. It doesn't sum well. If you sit there and you take 100 tracks and sum it 5.1 a stereo, it theoretically has the overhead, but it doesn't sound right. it's better to take some maybe a couple dozen tracks out of one output, put it to an analog console, sum it there. There's no summing. The summing amps, it just has a sound, which we've done tests with the Euphonics, with the Neve consoles, where we've taken direct output straight into the console, sum it, or do it internally, and it doesn't sound the same.
Is it smeared? Is it kind of
It doesn't have the
slightly
low end, doesn't have the punch.
No,
nothing. Not as smeared. It just doesn't.
It sounds crowded.
It's the imaging folds a little bit. It's the difference when you look at a video, a really good analog video at high def.
So it's kind of like the effect where you trim the VCA on an SSL console to make it open up again.
Yeah, no,
but you can't do that.
It's funny that you said that. That's exactly what you have to do in Pro Tools. You have to assign a VCA, bring it back, because if you're sitting there slamming 192 tracks out of 5.1, it has a sound.
Yeah, it does this.
It's a little distorted. It's a little digital. It just – you don't have the air around things
collapses in.
A little bit. I mean, it's way better with the 192s, but it definitely has a sound. And – it was interesting because when I was doing my mixes in Pro Tools and I'd go to a mixing stage, I'd go, why can't I get my mixes to sound like that? There's a certain roundness on the top where it doesn't get edgy. It's not sharp. Right. It's full sounding. The low end has body. The mid-range is clean without being muddy. There's all these different things. And when it all sums in Pro Tools, it just has a sound, which is why a lot of us are looking for multi-channel summing mixers.
Were these tests done with the dithered mixer or the undithered mixer in Pro Tools? Do you know?
It's done with the mixer that allows you to get 180 tracks.
That would be the non-dithered.
The non-dithered. I mean, nobody I know on the planet even knows about the dithered mixer. And we've discussed it, but nobody – I mean
– it's really good.
you know.
I mean, we use it. It does sound a little bit better. I mean, it's not huge, but it does sound a little better.
Do you still find it collapses, though?
Not so much that it's annoying. I mean, we're not usually doing as many tracks as he's talking about.
It also depends if you do it a lot.
It's not distracting for us.
I'll tell you something. I think you'll find it happens more even on a lot lesser track count than you. Obviously,
oh, yeah.
I mean,
I've heard 128 is an interesting number.
Maybe I'm just dreaming, but I've heard it on 24 tracks of audio pumping into two tracks in a Pro Tools system. I start to lose the sound. The sound of 24 tracks coming into an analog console, and you're summing it there. Obviously, you've got combination of problems and sounds going on, all coupling and decoupling, whatever. But there's a thing that happens where the console eventually, left and right, buzz gives out and says, "Listen, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to start distorting here." But right up until then, each instrument doesn't get affected by another instrument in the mix as much as it does in Pro Tools or digital system. I find that if you have like a lot of instruments in the same range in Pro Tools and you start summing it digitally in Pro Tools and go to two outputs, that middle area sounds like a white noise. You start losing harmonic content. You start, now what the hell is that? It's just like,
I find it on the musical approach.
But it doesn't happen with an analog console. The analog console says, oh, I'm going to just keep doing this. Granted, it's mostly doing a lot of other horrible things to the sound, but it just sounds, it certainly sounds more stable. It holds up better. And a really great test is if you have mono tracks in Pro Tools that have reverb with a decent organic reverb tail in it, like a drum kit in a decent room, stick it through and sum them all down. And, you know, for a pop mix, I'm saying. So stick them up in the mix, in your digital mix, slam it to your left and right bus, but don't go into the red, just do a nice mix and have a listen to it. And then do the same on an analog console, zero the console out so you have equal, so you fair one-to-one test. Mm-hmm. You'll find that the verb tails on all those tracks are much more understandable and unaffected and uncomplicated on the analog console. Granted, it will hiss more, but it sounds better.
I had an interesting...
It's a bummer.
Just as a little insert here, I had an interesting conversation with a chap. I actually never met the chap before, but he worked on one of the... it was Wally, right? And evidently that was mixed on a Neve. And if you listen to the audio on that movie, it's very different sounding. It's punchy, and it's present, and it doesn't have any of that fizz.
Yeah.
which you find with a lot of movies, and it comes through transfer as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, there is a bloody difference.
You can use Pro Tools as a playback machine, and you can do it as a lot of mix, what we call pre-dubs, and it's really great. I find the final mix, the final summing, is still better in the the outside
analog domain,
Analog or even digital consoles. But just the, whatever summing algorithms.
Digital consoles too.
Yeah. Because we're doing all digital consoles now.
You know, that's interesting when you talk about the summing, because years ago I worked on the television campaign for Lord of the Rings, the very first movie. And the very first commercial that I did came to me with 62 tracks. And prior to that, probably the biggest mix that I had done being post-production and commercials was maybe, 24, maybe... 30 tracks. And I remember playing back to 60 tracks and it just sounded fuzzy. It just didn't sound right. And as I added tracks, as I took tracks away, it kind of cleared it up more and more. And then I put them back together. And that was actually the first time I even heard about this whole summing thing. Cause, prior to that, I had never heard about,
Were you on a 192 or 888?
No, this was, I think, an 888, because this is back
there.
See,
that's the thing. I would sit there and work on a mix, and the kick drum gets farther away from me. And then the second I went over to Logic, all of a sudden, I didn't really notice at first, but I would get my mixes done much quicker.
Right.
And then I compared the two. This is 888 versus...
Right.
And
it was, for me, it was such a learning experience, because when you hear it, you'll never forget, because your mix is just, it was just mushy, and you start thinking, wow, my ear's going, or, you start doubting yourself.
There's one thing as well, talking summing, I don't know if any guys here, we touched on a couple of months ago, parallel processing, I don't know if you guys are hip to that, but basically you are, I'm sure. But if you do it on an analog console and you do it in a digital, you do the same thing. Well, obviously, you can't do the same thing.
Like New York compression. Parallel.
Parallel and chaining and stuff like that. But you start to do it on an analog console, the thing just jumps right out the speakers. And you do it on a digital thing, and you can sit there with all the nice plugins. They're all really great. And they're all timeline. They're all phase coherent. It just doesn't have the same character. And it's the same sort of thing. It just is that same... Unfortunately, that thing we seem to prefer.
It's like you left the main signal in. That's all it does.
Yeah, it's like...
But I find that if you're doing funk, hip-hop, certain things that have a little bit of bite to it, it's almost the difference between the English sound, the American sound, and the Japanese sound. If you look at the electronics, I find the Japanese electronics have a little bit of a bite, a little bit of edge, a little bit of snap. I find the British... sound, I'm grossly generalizing here, is much more of a warmer sound. It's much more of a rounder sound, and Americans are kind of in the middle. And even in cinema, it's very interesting how that's different. We're doing video games. We have a lot of Japanese clients. They like everything having that kind of that high-end, edgy, they just like that sound. Bite. And Americans, I like the big round, I like to hear air around it and make that low-end thwop because I'm from Hollywood, So,
Really?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting on the differences of sounds. So I find that, especially we're talking about the 888s, the old ones.
Oh, those are horrible.
And because the thing Rob and I were programming a lot for Lexicon and doing a lot of presets. And I became a reverb junkie on TC and Lexicon. And I recorded all the reverbs. And none of them, you A-B it. And it was nothing like it just wouldn't translate. All of a sudden, the reverbs would fold in. All the detail and the air that you'd get from them squashed.
Everything was behind everything.
Yes. Yeah. And it just went like, why can't I get this to record correctly on the 888? So 192s have gotten better.
I think so.
Yeah.
And that's why music sounded so crappy, around the year 2000. When did the 888s come in?
But there were a lot of people, a lot of it was work block based, and there was a big thing where everyone went out and bought DB technology,
Well, we can see that, through this discussion on the tools, how it's kind of all blurred and actually, you can see how it kind of laid the foundation for a lot of musicians to go into post, because they did have the analog consoles and they did have some really good sounding, gear the post people, you know, hadn't heard. And even nowadays, it's amazing when I work with music that I get from composers for like independent films. I can totally tell the guy who's working on like an analog system as opposed to the guy that gives me bounced files from a Pro Tools. Maybe because I know these two composers, but one composer, when I hear their stuff, it's always punchy and warm, and I know his studio is all analog based. And the other one, who does it all in the box, it has the box sound, you know.
I think the timing dynamic is different. Because when I, you know, it was interesting. I did studio musicians. I did Cherokee, where we would spend a day figuring the right guitar amp. And we go, let's take Lukather's head.
Luxury.
Yeah, we take the Lukather's head, and we'll grab that amp, and oh, the guitar player play a couple licks. Now let's try that amp and that head and that speaker. And we just spend all day long with different speakers. This was the 80s.
I was just laughing.
Now, I think what's interesting with post at, you know, when you're mixing, it's $1,000 to $1,300 an hour. There's no, like, hey, let's try this. Let's try that. Hey, I got a great idea. Let's think outside the box and try. That's, to be honest, what most of the sound designers do. But mixing, it's all about speed. You know, it's just bang, 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 do it. And you have to know your tricks.
It's funny. I just remember talking of Bax, where I met Bax, just a quick bit of history, but a nice recording we did at one stage was Bax did a solo record, and that's when I met him. And I was we recorded it at a studio, and we cut it to 16-track 2-inch, and we bounced it to 32-track. Remember, 32-track dig.
32-track dig, yeah.
And it was
3-amp.
As opposed to about XA50 with the apertures, yeah. And it was.
I don't know what it was, actually.
XA50.
All right, okay.
Yeah, with apertures.
Oh, right. Yeah, with apertures on it.
We ran it, and we cut it.
We cooked on it.
We did.
It was so bloody hot. You could cook breakfast on
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
It looked like it.
Yeah. How did it sound?
It was good because we cut. Remember, we did 15 nips.
Basics on two.
We did drums at 15 nips and 16 track. Yep. Then we did overdubs on the dig. Then we went back to 30 nips, and I put up a 16 track head. Then we changed the 24 track head. I think we did. And we did guitars.
But how much time did you have when you did all that?
Well, while I laugh, because we worked on the record for about 10 months, right?
It's 10 years, I think.
But the guitar sound, we took about 8 days to get one. But remember, we were just trying amps and mic and things. But I'm just saying, that's the whole different way of producing these days. Then people do like a whole movie. They shoot the whole movie and do the soundtrack in 8 days.
It was interesting. When I was doing the music thing, I was doing that. And then I worked at a guy named Pete Woodford's studio as the guitar player for The Tonight Show. And all Ed Shaughnessy, all these guys would come in. And they'd just sit there, look at the music and go, you know, instruments were still in the cases. Love the tune. Then they go out, they play it, and they go, okay, I got about 4 of these gigs today, so let's do it. And they go, you know, Scott, just roll tape, record it. 1, 2. And they play it through, and they go, oh, okay, measure 32, hit me on the end of 4. 1, 2. And then, and cue. 23 cues done in about an hour. Everyone, thank you very much.
Sounds like took professionals
the cases,
to me.
Off to the next session.
Yeah. Wow.
And that was like, you know, I was, you know, pretty much tinkling at that point because everything was going so quick and there's no Pro Tools. So it's like, we just did the background singers there. There's no more room on the 24 track. I just punch them in, but don't erase them.
Come by tomorrow because we didn't get any of that. But we got levels.
Listen, we're running out of time, but you know what? This will be the first part. We're going to talk a little bit about the whole blurring of the lines because we talked about the blurring of the lines with the tools today. But, you know, on some other podcasts, we'll have to talk about the workflow and some of the other things that are kind of happening out there where, you know, music and post and opportunities are all kind of blurring together. Before we go, we got to talk about one thing, and we'll talk about it really quick because we had a listener email us.
I know where this is going.
That's going to be quick.
It sure is.
Microsoft came out with a product called...
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Called Songsmith.
We love
and it's,
Microsoft.
And it's purely evil and it's the devil.
Songsmith
but,
rocks.
But if you want to know what Songsmith is, it's basically Microsoft's kind of answer to GarageBand. And essentially you sing in a tone, you pick a style, you sing into a microphone, it records you with drums, and then it basically analyzes what pitch you're singing and it throws in the accompaniment. Meant behind it.
GarageBand doesn't do that, though, does it?
No.
GarageBand requires actual talent.
This is what's awesome, is this is Microsoft's
version of GarageBand.
Right.
That's what's awesome.
And so what was asked of us is what we thought about that. And my opinion on that is it's really the absolute backwards way to work, where you're just singing into it and hopefully the instruments will fill in behind you. And I think in the long
run... Sounds like records these days.
Like American Idol or something.
I think in the long run, it's actually going to hurt, because there's no shortcut to good music.
Actually, you know something? I thought about this before I drove down here, as I was driving down here, and I think it's a great thing. I really do.
I'm going to take
the other side of it. I think, you know what it's going to be? It's going to be hours and hours of hilarious fun.
This is right, Bobby. This is right.
I'm going to buy the program.
You're right.
And I'm going to sing in the melody
Absolutely.
Of all famous songs. I'm going to go, hey, dude.
You know what? Someone see already what it did. It's on YouTube.
And this is what it is.
It's
like
a whole album.
It's like kung fu movies. It is so bad. It's good.
No.
That's what it is.
Guys.
Real quick. But I'm going to try to get a pirate copy.
What this is, I'm going to do a game analogy. You got PS3 and 360, that the graphics are amazing. The thing is so real. You know, you could be there. It's the Wii. It's the thing. So if you want to be real gaming, you ain't playing the Wii. You're probably playing PS3 or 360. This thing is for mom and pop who can't really sing at all, but just want to have a little bit of fun.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's nothing to sit there as a tool in what we do is ludicrous.
You know what?
But it is entertaining. Mm.
It is a way for talentless people to write horrible, horrible music. That's what it is.
And that's what we need.
If only we could do the same.
It is fun. The thing that I will say, it is fun to make fun of it because it's so god-awful.
And it's amazing.
The ad for it on the web, everybody who sees it thinks it's a joke. Everybody thinks it's from Saturday Night Live.
I thought it was. I really did it.
Yeah, I had to convince my wife. She had to do a Snopes on it to make sure that it was real.
I mean, it is real. It's embarrassing. And
what did you say about Band in a Box earlier?
Well, the accompaniment that it comes up with isn't even as good as what Band in the Box used to do. You remember that from the 80s or 90s, whatever that was?
They still sell that thing, I think.
It'd be perfect for kids, actually.
You know what, though?
It's
What's
evil.
Perfect for kids is GarageBand, where you actually have to maybe decide something. Yeah, you have
My
to
come
little
up boy
with something.
Came up with drum and bass cue the other day in GarageBand. I'm like, dang.
No. But we're talking about the player organ at home, they play come on, everybody sing along.
But at least with those things, you go and you have to at least play the chords of the track.
Right.
This thing is nothing.
It's everything for you. Just add water and sing.
There are some things that are bad, and then some things that are so bad that they're good. And then some things that are so bad that they're back to bad again. And that's what this is. This is so far from good. I really don't see anything redeeming about it. When you watch the commercial, I mean, everybody should check it out.
I'm going to buy it. It's funny, but it's not trying to be.
It's pretty hilarious.
Okay, can I tell you one thing?
Maybe Bill Gates needs to check it out.
The highlight of the NAMM show for me is when I saw that guy at the NAMM show.
You saw the guy from the commercial?
The singer?
He was there at the NAMM show. It is for real.
Did you buy a coffee from him?
But I just think it's evil. I just think it's going to, you know, I don't know. You're right. It's probably good for mom and pop.
Why do you say it's evil? I'm intrigued.
Well, because I think it's going to – it's for people who want to take a shortcut to making good music.
No, not at all.
Because everybody can hear that it's not good.
It's a gimmick. It's a kid's gimmick.
It's a gimmick.
It's the equivalent of using a kazoo or a recorder on a track.
Yes,
but it really isn't
because
they're...
They're
trying to pretend that you're writing music by doing it. But the thing is this. It is to singing what Guitar Hero is to guitar playing. Except it's not as much fun because the music in Guitar Hero is pretty cool. The music that this thing puts out sounds like it came out of a Casio wristwatch 20 years ago.
All I'm saying is the way they're trying to sell it is a music-making tool, and I think if you rely on that as your music-making tool, it's in the long run you're going.
But no. It goes on the shelf with Kmart with the little keyboard.
I understand.
The FM sense.
I understand.
I remember that's strings. That was drums.
Listen.
You know,
I find it so encouraging from this perspective. if Microsoft is this far out to sea, then that's good for me. I'm like, you guys keep going.
It's hard to believe they have so lost the plot.
Have so lost their way.
Vista, hello, we won't even go down there. Yeah.
All right, well, hey, listen, we can go on for hours, and you know what? I don't like Brussels sprouts either, and you're not going to convince me that they're good. So let's just go. Let's leave
it at that. I'll get on the Brussels sprouts or evil cake.
Broccoli.
You know, broccoli.
Up until this point, I enjoyed myself. But you just had to bring up Brussels sprouts.
And you know where Brussels sprouts come from, right? You know where they come from, Baxter?
What, Brussels sprouts?
England.
What?
England, yeah.
No, Microsoft.
and they think they're a vegetable, right?
Hands gave you the horns.
Yeah, right.
Oh, God.
All right. Well,
I knew this was a mistake.
We're going to have to wrap this up. But Baxter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's just been a great podcast,
and it's been really fun, and I appreciate it. Are you working on anything besides the box set? I mean, do you know when that's going to be coming out? Anything you want to?
I'm going to do a new album.
Oh, great. Great.
And I will buy it. Because I know I'm going to pay for it. That's what I'm going to do next. I've just finished a bunch of stuff, and that's what I'm going to concentrate on.
Oh, that's great. Well, you have to keep us updated.
I will keep you updated, and let's hope I can still entertain people.
We spent an hour being entertained here, so.
You're gonna probably
that's for sure.
Yeah, you're probably gonna need your right hand back.
It's warm and cozy.
But Rob is still smiling.
That's right. Oh, and just don't use Songsmith, and it'll be okay.
I recommend you use Songsmith.
I recommend you try anything to make music on, because that's really what it's
except
about.
That. Except Songsmith.
Rob, what are you up to?
I'm doing a new series of commercials for Songsmith. Yeah. Really looking forward to it.
Do you mean real ones?
No.
Do they involve Brussels sprouts?
They will now.
Oh, man.
Actually, I am I'm up to my usual many music endeavors, but one of the things I'm doing that is a little out of the ordinary is I'm working on a new non-visual system for Stevie. You know, I come up with his non-visual writing systems from time to time, and he's been using sort of variations of one I came up with years ago for many years. He's been using it, and I've just been updating it, and we've been getting better computers. But we're actually now going to try. We've tried a few times before without success, but I think it's time he can actually use a Macintosh instead of a PC for some things, which is going to be really interesting because, you know, there's lots of software on the Mac that's really easy to use, but not a lot of it is easy to use with your eyes closed.
Right.
And I think now with Apple Script and some other technologies, Leopard finally has it to where it might actually be really, really accessible for the blind. So this is something that I'm going to be working on a lot in the next few weeks, but
Rob called me today and told me when he started finding it, got me all excited. So I'm like, yes.
Because the automation stuff in Windows has been good. There have been a lot of good macro languages and a lot of really cool interfaces. And there are even MIDI sequencer packages that are specifically set up for the blind. There are extensions for Sonar called Cake Talking that are really good, that make it non-visual. And there have been applications on the Mac in the past. But the way Stevie likes to work and the way I like to customize things, and at this point I've been doing that for him for, 24 years, so we kind of know what works for him and what doesn't. I finally feel like with the tools in Leopard, I can actually build something that's as customized as it needs to be, and there are a lot of benefits to being on the Mac for music as well. So it's an interesting little bit of experimentation. And at the same time, I'm trying to finish two albums and a commercial campaign.
And you've got to finish that book.
Yeah, there is
that. Apple Script is 800 pages long, right?
Yeah, which I'm looking forward to. Actually, that's a lot of fun.
And somewhere you'll eat and sleep in that whole timeline.
I did that back in December, so yeah, I'm good.
Bill, what are you up to?
I am working on my record, which when I'm not doing the other stuff.
Right.
And I've got my two tutorials that are going, intro to post-production, Pro Tools 8, and then after that is live with Live 8. And I just did a couple, three little bits for Japanese television game show, and we're waiting to see how that comes out.
Great.
I don't know if it's going to get picked up.
And where your tutorials are on Mac Pro?
Mac Pro Video.
Mac Pro Video. Great.
And then I'm also doing more of my reverse orchestration, where I have a couple of legit, you know, orchestral guys that contract me to bump their stuff up into the electronic space.
Oh, that's cool.
And but unfortunately, the project I'm on is a fitness video, so it's like putting good kick drums on aerobics for housewives, I think. But hey, it is what it is, right?
Gigs again.
Also, Rob, I have people in New York City that work with the Foundation of the Blind on Mac and on Logic.
Cool. So, except for the Logic part, that's excellent.
Yeah,
that's true.
We'll talk about it.
Logic is a very cool program.
It is.
For some people.
It absolutely is, just not for what we're trying to do.
It might be...
I use Logic plenty. I deal with a lot of producers who bring me projects in Logic, and one of the albums I finished today actually was done entirely in Logic and GarageBand, actually.
Really?
Some of it was started in GarageBand, and then we brought it over into Logic and then mixed it from within Logic. But I'm a huge fan of Logic for some things, but not for everything.
No.
Forrest, what are you up to?
I'm actually working on... It's years overdue, but my first solo record just needs to be done. So I'm starting off on a wonderful Yamaha grand piano that I love in the sanctuary at my church, actually.
What kind of sticks do you use on that?
Must use mallets.
Forrest Robinson custom golden-tipped.
TVs.
Yeah, right.
Prepared piano by Forrest.
I mean, but,
don't,
you know.
Check the keys.
I really want to get this music out and see where it goes. So far, it's been completely ethereal and solo piano, but I love like lush orchestrations and everything too. So I'm not sure whether drums and percussion are going to come in with it yet, but it will.
Right.
And I'm really happy about this track that I did on a Black Sabbath solo. I mean, on Black Sabbath tribute album that's coming out the top of this year with the song playing on "Killing Yourself to Live." So it's like Bill Ward, except has some double bass stuff in there they let me do. So I'm really happy about that. And besides that, you know, I'm hoping to get some sort of leads on, like, getting the whole more drum clinics going on. I did one at LA Music Academy a couple weekends ago, and it was turned into mostly heavy metal, double bass, and world music, and everybody dug it. And, you know,
great.
Get more reels together for that.
Scott.
I can honestly say I'm slow for the next 2 weeks and loving every moment of it.
That's great.
I mean, it's like I'm actually looking at it going, wow, there's people and sky and...
And my child.
And my child. No, and my son. And also a little plug, we've got a bunch of nominations for awards coming up this weekend.
Which is the Academy Awards.
The Academy Awards and the Golden Reel Awards.
And the Golden Reel Awards.
And we got some... we just found out today we got noms for the Gang Awards.
Great.
For video games. So... I'm up for Hellboy, Gears of War 2, and Fable 2.
Great.
So stay tuned, and we'll see how it plays out on Saturday.
Wow. That's great.
And then our company's up for Wanted at the Academy Awards, which we did. So.
Well, break a leg.
Oh, thank you.
That's great.
That's bloody great.
That's great.
Bobby.
Doing finishing off a fun little project, just basically Baroque kind of oriented songs that people can upload and download and write their own stuff to. So I'll tell you more about it when I know more about it, basically.
Okay, great.
Good fun.
Well, I want to tell everybody that we have a Facebook webpage up, and if you're out there and you're on Facebook, you can come join us. I won't tell you what the URL is because Facebook has all those different, you know, /topic/124789, you know, semicolon, dollar sign. But if you go to, but I'll post a link to it on the blog. And also I want to thank, Jason Moon out there for, sending us a little, a note of encouragement and just want to let you.
Thank you, Jason.
Jason.
Yeah,
thank
you.
Jason. We do read.
Thank you, Jason.
We do read. What you post.
We read at a third grade level, but we do read.
So join us on Facebook. And if you want to ask, you know, any of the guys a question or the whole panel in general, you can always post it there on a discussion.
And I think Hez did an excellent engineering job this evening.
We gotta give props to Hez. And also I want to give props to my brother who's in charge of the Facebook page. He set the
What's
whole
your brother's
thing.
Name? Introduce
Ben Rodriguez.
Thank you.
And a little plug for Hez. He's doing something really cool. You want to jump in?
Sure.
Oh, come on.
If it's okay.
Yeah, if
come.
You're good.
Yes, we
this is really kind of cool.
What is this?
Well, he's got some cool information. Go ahead.
Well, can you hear me here?
Yeah, we can.
So,
we have to talk to the engineer. He'll move a fader.
Phantom engineer. So, I'll be the new cinematics layout or previs supervisor at Blizzard Entertainment Global.
Yeah. And for those people that know Blizzard, that's World of Warcraft.
World of Warcraft.
So, doing virtual camera work and all that kind of good stuff for World of Warcraft and Diablo and all these other things.
When's the NL console coming?
After I get a paycheck, how's that?
And, you know, I just want to remind everybody that has got that job because of the Audio Now cast.
That's right.
That's true.
Oh, really?
Well, it is now.
All right. Well, hey, I just want to thank everybody for listening to us. And Baxter, thank you so much for
Baxter, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right. So check out our Facebook page, and we'll catch you all next time. Take it easy. Bye bye.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaulo and uses Aphex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.